I next met with Dr. Haygop Kantarjian, and to begin, we discuss what's new in management of AML.
In acute myeloid leukemia, we're starting to get a lot of those novel therapies which I think are going to impact the prognosis of AML. So let's start with the FLT3 ITD mutation and FLT3 inhibitors. So FLT3 abnormalities occur in about 20 to 30% of patients with acute myeloid leukemia. And over the past 10 years, we tested several FLT3 inhibitors, and now those results are coming to fruition. So one of the studies that was reported at ASH but not ASCO is a frontline randomized study in acute myeloid leukemia, FLT3 positive, in which patients were randomized to the standard chemotherapy 3+7 with or without one of the FLT3 inhibitors called midostaurin. And this study shows an improvement in the survival of patients when midostaurin was added. So this establishes the role of FLT3 inhibitors, and we're hoping that at least this drug will be approved soon for the treatment of patients.
Just to pick up on that, there also was a study the previous year, ASH 2014, looking at sorafenib, but I guess there wasn't a survival benefit.
Well, there was a benefit, but it depended on how you looked at the analysis. So as you pointed out, sorafenib is a drug that's already approved for other indications, and it is one of the most potent FLT3 inhibitors. So there was a study in Germany that looked at the addition of sorafenib to standard chemotherapy, and they showed a significant improvement in event-free survival, but not in survival, because many more patients received transplant in the standard arm. But the bulk of the data suggests that FLT3 inhibitors are going to become a standard of care. And one of the questions is whether they would benefit also patients who are FLT3 wild type. Because in the study with midostaurin, there was a benefit for patients who are FLT3 point mutations who are not supposed to benefit. So people are going to start looking at FLT3 inhibitors in general.
Now, as could I just ask also, before you go on into some of the new ones, I was kind of surprised that midostaurin hasn't been approved now. I mean, it's been 6 months since ASH, and at ASH, everybody I talked to was saying, oh yeah, it's going to get approved. Is there some reason that's not happened?
No, I think what has happened is the study is through the cooperative groups, and perhaps the drug company did not anticipate that benefit because the study has been going on for about 10 years. So now they have to go and recollect the data to submit it to the FDA, and that may be taking longer. But I have no doubt in my mind that midostaurin is a powerful drug, and this was a randomized study that showed the benefits. So we should see an FDA approval or an approval for midostaurin. Beyond this, you mentioned sorafenib, which people use extensively as an added treatment to either epigenetic therapy or the standard chemotherapy in acute myeloid leukemia. And you mentioned crenelanib as one of several new FLT3 inhibitors. Crenelanib has the capacity of targeting FLT3 point mutations, so it could expand potentially the role of FLT3 inhibitors. The other agent is venetoclax, which is also known as ABT-199. And this is a drug that is already approved for the treatment of chronic lymphocytic leukemia as of a month ago. But we find venetoclax to be quite a powerful agent in combination today with epigenetic therapy in the phase 1-2 studies. But I think in the future, also in combination with intensive chemotherapy, and perhaps it will have an expanded role beyond chronic lymphocytic leukemia and acute myeloid leukemia. Many of us believe that it could have a role also in the setting of acute lymphocytic leukemia in combination with chemotherapy, or potentially as an added treatment in chronic myeloid leukemia with minimal residual disease to eradicate the disease and cure patients molecularly. So venetoclax is a very powerful drug, a BCL2 inhibitor that I think will have an ever-expanding role across the hematologic malignancies.
Just to pick up on that, is the data that we have right now, for example, there was this big oral presentation at ASCO using venetoclax with low-dose cytarabine. The data that we have right now, is it looks promising enough that you think this is going to actually enter practice at some time in the next few years, or this is just sort of a long-term dream?
No, I think this will have a near time. I think venetoclax is a powerful agent in acute myeloid leukemia, and we will see the results coming to fruition in the near future rather than a long-term future or as a dream. So venetoclax on its own has modest activity in acute myeloid leukemia, but when we added it to epigenetic therapy such as azacitidine and decitabine in elderly people with acute myeloid leukemia, we started seeing complete response rates of about 75%, which is very promising in a situation where the drug or the combination has minimal side effects, and where in the past epigenetic therapy with azacitidine and decitabine produced complete responses of only 30 to 35%. So I think venetoclax will continue to be investigated, and we're hoping to come soon to pivotal studies. One possibility is to use the situation of elderly acute myeloid leukemia, where we could do randomized studies of epigenetic therapy with or without venetoclax with a survival endpoint, and that should hopefully establish the drug as useful in this situation, and then we can expand into the younger AML population and across other leukemias.
What about that strategy, venetoclax and hypomethylating agent in MDS? Do we know anything about that?
So it's interesting that you mention this, because we have already proposed studies in myelodysplastic syndrome, and there are two ways of doing it. We can do, for example, single-arm trials of azacitidine or decitabine with venetoclax, and then if the studies look very positive, then do a frontline randomized study. Alternatively, we could take patients who have failed azacitidine or decitabine and randomize them to continuation of the standard of care versus adding venetoclax. So you would be targeting the salvage situation, where the answers as to the benefit will come much faster.
We were starting to talk about new FLT3 inhibitors, and I wanted to get your take on whether any of them look particularly encouraging to you. You mentioned crenolanib that you all presented at ASCO, and there's another drug, gilteritinib. I was curious about these and other new agents. Do you think they present any potential advantages compared to something like midostaurin?
What I've learned from doing multiple studies of me-too drugs is you have to test them across the board. So, for example, with the FLT3 inhibitors, when we started with CEP701, and even with the midostaurin, these were thought to be weaker agents. Certainly, the CEP701 did not pass muster in the studies, but midostaurin was a big, very positive surprise. So I think there's room for improvement. I personally believe that quizartinib and sorafenib are very potent FLT3 inhibitors. Unfortunately, unlike the midostaurin situation, we do not have yet any form of randomized studies that could allow us in the near future to look at these drugs as available in the standard of practice. But I think there will be more potent FLT3 inhibitors. In particular, sorafenib is one. Quizartinib, in my experience, is also a very powerful one, and there could be others. So I think there's room for improvement with the FLT3 inhibitors, but I'm very happy that there are at least two of them that we could potentially use: sorafenib, which is a commercial drug, and hopefully midostaurin soon.
Anything else going on with AML you want to comment on?
There are several things in acute myeloid leukemia beyond the FLT3 inhibitors and venetoclax that look very promising. So to summarize things a little bit, as you know, acute promyelocytic leukemia is a disease where we established now that ATRA-arsenic trioxide as a form of non-chemotherapy is superior to the AIDA regimen, which is idarubicin and ATRA. So I think we should have a much better penetration of ATRA-arsenic trioxide in acute promyelocytic leukemia, and that should lead to a potential cure rate of 90%. The other subset are the core binding factor leukemias, so inversion 16 and translocation 821, where improved regimens with FLAG-IDA-like therapy now result in cure rates of 80%, so far beyond the 50% that's reported in the literature. Beyond those two categories, I think we're seeing a lot of targeted therapies that would improve the outcome soon. So we discussed the FLT3 inhibitors and venetoclax as a BCL2 inhibitor, but I think we should pay attention to a whole broad spectrum of monoclonal antibodies targeting CD33 and CD123, and they come in multiple flavors. One of them are the monoclonal antibodies conjugated to toxins. The other flavor are the bispecific monoclonal antibodies, which associate CD33 with CD3 as the killer. And finally, some of the CAR T cells, which may be coming in the setting of acute myeloid leukemia. And they target usually CD33 or CD123. So there's a whole program with the monoclonal antibodies, which should mature soon. Then I want to mention the subset of patients with AML and IDH1 or 2 mutations, which constitutes on average about 20% of patients with AML. And here we have several IDH inhibitors, in particular AG221, an IDH2 inhibitor, which appears to be quite powerful, and we're moving in combinations with chemotherapy. There are also IDH1 inhibitors, including AG120 and IDH305, which are ongoing trials and which are very promising. So aside from the FLT3 inhibitors and the monoclonal antibodies, I think we will see the establishment of IDH inhibitors as an important strategy in acute myeloid leukemia in the setting of patients who are IDH mutation. And finally, I want to mention two chemotherapy drugs. So we're very fascinated with the targeted therapies, but there are studies with two chemotherapy drugs. One is CPX351, which is an engineered formulation, liposomal formulation of donomycin and Ara-C. And to many people's surprise, the randomized study in the setting of the higher risk acute myeloid leukemia just showed the survival advantage. But we need to see how much benefit is added with using CPX351 over standard chemotherapy. The other drug is Vosaroxin, which is a TOPO2 inhibitor, and the pivotal studies in Salvage 1 with high-dose Ara-C plus or minus Vosaroxin showed a survival benefit, but it did not meet the statistical endpoint. So I think maybe Vosaroxin could have a European approval, but not a United States approval. We'll have to see how this plays out. But that sums up most of the exciting research in acute myeloid leukemia.
Let's talk a little bit about ALL. Of course, docs in general practice don't see it much, but I think there's so many things going on. It's really fascinating. We saw some more data with CAR T therapy, also blinatumomab that your groups work with. What's new in ALL that a general oncologist would like want to know about?
I think we are seeing a revolution in motion in adult acute lymphocytic leukemia, and that revolution will come from two areas. The first one are the monoclonal antibodies that target CD19 and CD22, and the second one in the CAR T cells. So as you pointed out, blinatumomab is a bispecific monoclonal antibody that attaches to CD3 and CD19. The mature data are showing very positive results in terms of marrow complete response rates of about 40 to 50%. And at the EHA meeting, there was the report of the randomized study of blinatumomab versus chemotherapy in the setting of ALL salvage that showed a survival advantage favoring blinatumomab. So this adds to the data that supports that blinatumomab is going to be a very important agent in the treatment of acute lymphocytic leukemia. Now, the difference in the median survival was 7.8 versus 4 months, and many of the patients relapsed. So I think the role of the monoclonals will be further improved by looking at combined modality approaches of monoclonals with chemotherapy, monoclonal cocktails, and then moving those studies from the salvage setting to the frontline setting. I really believe that adding the monoclonals to the frontline ALL therapy will allow us to shorten the duration of the treatment from 2.5 to 3 years down to about 6 months, so maybe 3 months of chemotherapy, 3 months of a monoclonal cocktail. So there'll be less toxicity, better compliance, and a higher potential cure rate. And if that happens in the elderly and adult ALL, I think there'll be a lot of pressure to even change the way we treat pediatric leukemia, even though their cure rate is in the range of 80 to 90%. The other monoclonal antibody that was reported earlier in pilot trials and now in a randomized study is a drug called inotuzumab, which is a CD22 monoclonal antibody bound to calicheamycin. And again, at the EHA meeting in Europe, we reported on the randomized study comparing inotuzumab to standard of care chemotherapy, and that demonstrated a survival advantage with a two-year survival rate of 23% with inotuzumab versus 10% with the chemotherapy. Again, the median survival improvement is modest, but I think the role of monoclonals after being approved for the treatment of ALL will be to use combinations. We have at our institution a chemotherapy combination with inotuzumab, and we're showing already almost a doubling of the median survival compared to what is seen with either chemotherapy or with inotuzumab.
Anything else going on with ALL, and specifically what's happening with CAR T therapy?
So there's a lot of excitement about the CAR T cell therapies. And as you know, there are different methodologies and they have been taken by multiple drug companies. Also, the current CAR T cells are all autologous CAR T cells. You take the lymphocytes from the patients, expand them and give them back to the patient. There are companies which are looking at off-the-shelf allogeneic CAR T cells. So the same way you order blood transfusions and platelet transfusions, in the future, we would possibly be able to just order off-the-shelf CAR T cells and giving them to the patient. And that will be a major breakthrough if they turn to be as active as the autologous CAR T cells. So we have to keep paying attention to the CAR T cells. Today, people use them in the salvage setting. They have a lot of toxicities. I think in the future, they could be used again in the frontline setting. So if we cannot cure all or most of the patients with chemotherapy and monoclonal antibodies, then maybe the addition of the CAR T cells as one last treatment at the end of the treatment could accomplish this. One other aspect I want to mention are the patients with Philadelphia positive acute lymphocytic leukemia. So now the combinations of chemotherapy with tyrosine kinase inhibitors are showing for the first time 5-year survival rates over 50%. And we have a recent experience with hyper-CVAD ponatinib, which is a powerful tyrosine kinase inhibitor against BCR-ABL, where the CR rate is almost universal and the 3-year survival is 80%. So it is possible in the future that we will be able to cure most of the patients with Philadelphia positive ALL without resorting to allogeneic transplantation. Now, a twist to that is if monoclonal antibodies such as blinatumomab and inotuzumab are superior to chemotherapy, can we combine them in Philadelphia positive ALL with tyrosine kinase inhibitors again to develop non-chemotherapy regimens which improve the cure rates beyond what we see with tyrosine kinase inhibitors and chemotherapy and also reduce the toxicity? So I would keep a close eye on Philadelphia positive ALL and the further development of non-chemotherapy regimens with BCR-ABL inhibitors in combination with those CD19 and CD22 monoclonal antibodies.
So let's talk a little bit about CML, and I want to find out what's new in terms of the generic introduction of imatinib. But before we do, we saw some more data on the continuing theme of, is it possible to discontinue TKI therapy in these patients? Can you talk about what was presented at ASCO and where we are today on that general question?
There's no doubt that there is a subset of patients with chronic myeloid leukemia who become PCR negative for durable periods, more than 2 to 3 years, where if you stop the therapy, half of them will not have recurrence of the disease. So these are truly molecular cures. Now let's look at the proportion of these patients. So if you treat, say, 100 patients with tyrosine kinase inhibitors, most of them will achieve a major molecular response, but anywhere from 40 to 70% will achieve a complete molecular response, PCR negativity, and those responses are durable more than 2 years in 30 to 40% of the patients. So if we discontinue the treatment, we're looking at about 15 to 20% of patients with CML who are molecularly cured and do not require additional long-term tyrosine kinase inhibitor therapies. So this brings the question of, are there some of those tyrosine kinase inhibitors that induce a higher rate of durable complete molecular cures, and should we use them over the generic imatinib, which we hope will be much less expensive? So here's how I see things developing. In general, the generic imatinib will be an outstanding agent for patients with lower risk chronic myeloid leukemia and for patients who are perhaps over the age of 60, where using a safe and highly effective BCR-ABL inhibitor like the generic imatinib could take them throughout their normal lifetime. Now, if you have a patient with higher risk chronic myeloid leukemia by the SOCAL model or others, or a patient who's young, say under the age of 50, those are patients who may potentially benefit from frontline second generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors, because you don't want somebody who's 50 to receive tyrosine kinase inhibitors for the rest of their life. So this will be a situation where a second generation tyrosine kinase inhibitor could improve the potential rate of durable complete molecular response and the chance of discontinuing the treatment. So this is how I view the future evolving, the generic imatinib having a major role in frontline therapy because it's highly effective, it is safe, and it would be not expensive. But then the second generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors having an expanded role in the salvage setting, but also in the frontline setting, perhaps in the high-risk SOCAL CML, and among the younger patients where achievement of a durable complete molecular response may be more important.
I've got to say, I'm a little surprised by the age thing you just said, because it seems like even age 60, even beyond that, people would still want to try to be cured. It sounds like you think there's maybe a higher chance of that happening with the second generation agents. Why wouldn't you use it?
So I think, as you pointed out, in the second generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors across the randomized studies are showing higher incidence of durable complete molecular response. The range is about perhaps 30% versus 20%. So there is an added benefit to the second generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors if the endpoint of the treatment is the achievement of a durable complete molecular response that results in discontinuation of therapy. But you have to spend a lot of money in the total denominator to be able to achieve this in the subset of the patients. So then one would think that perhaps a better role for the second generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors would be among the younger patients, where discontinuing the treatment to avoid the long-term side effects of the tyrosine kinase inhibitors may be more important. So if I have a patient who is 40 or 50, I would like them to achieve a durable complete molecular response to stop the treatment, because otherwise they'll be taking this treatment for the next 30 to 40 years, and there is the potential of atherosclerosis, accelerated aging, vaso-occlusive disease, kidney problems, and so on and so forth. Among the older patients, let's say somebody who's 65 to 70, they could safely take the tyrosine kinase inhibitors over the next, say, 10 to 20 years. And this is where a less expensive BCR-ABL inhibitor available to all may be able to, on average, save more lives than the more expensive second-generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors.
So would your approach to this change if, let's say, all three of these drugs were extremely inexpensive? Would you still have the same algorithm? In other words, is this driven to a great extent by the issue of cost?
It is driven by the issue of cost, because the second-generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors continue to increase in prices.
I want to ask you about myelofibrosis. Again, I saw some more data. You were involved with the COMFORT studies that were presented at ASCO on the JAK1/2 inhibitor ruxolitinib. Where are we today with JAK inhibitors and myeloproliferative disease in general, not just myelofibrosis, but also PVERA and thrombocytic PT?
I think as the data with the JAK2 inhibitors is maturing with myelofibrosis, we're noticing that it goes beyond the initial indication of ruxolitinib providing improvement in the symptoms and quality of life of the patients. Now we're seeing that the long-term results are demonstrating a survival benefit for ruxolitinib and myelofibrosis, as well as a resolution of the fibrosis in subsets of the patients. And this is critical because we are also developing fibrosis preventing agents. We're in the early phases, but perhaps in the future, the combination of JAK2 inhibitors with such new agents could change really the course of myelofibrosis into a much more indolent disease. Now, the JAK2 inhibitors have undergone studies in the setting of polycythemia vera, and there's no doubt that among patients who fail standard therapies, the JAK2 inhibitors are providing a very important treatment tool which should be a standard of care in that setting. So I think while the initial approval of ruxolitinib was a bit lukewarm and based on improvements in the symptoms, weight gain, resolution of the splenomegaly, as the data is maturing, we're finding that ruxolitinib and perhaps other JAK2 inhibitors, if they come to broad use, these agents will have a role beyond symptomatic relief and will improve survival and perhaps resolve fibrosis with the longer-term follow-ups.
What do we know about other JAK inhibitors? Do any seem to have any particular advantage? And also, there are sort of these anti-fibrosis agents they're looking at, too.
I'm very excited about the anti-fibrosis agents. There is one that we're developing, which is showing very early promising results. We're seeing resolution of the fibrosis, improvement of the cytopenia. So I look forward to the maturation of the data and perhaps combining these agents with JAK2 inhibitors. As far as the JAK2 inhibitors, it's interesting to look at that experience as a learning experience, because people say, well, why do you need to develop so many me-too drugs? Why so many JAK2 inhibitors? And in fact, if you look at the historical experience, there are about 12 to 13 JAK2 inhibitors that have been developed, and only one, ruxolitinib, has made it to the market. So it's important to continue to develop drugs with the same mechanism of action, because some of them may be superior and or less toxic than others. What we've seen is a dropout of many of those JAK2 inhibitors because of either lack of efficacy or particular toxicities such as neurotoxicity, severe diarrhea, and others. I'm hoping that there's still room to develop additional JAK2 inhibitors, and two of them seem to be promising and continue to be under investigation.
You had a paper in AACR defining the immune checkpoint landscape of AML. Obviously, we're talking about immune checkpoint inhibitors nowadays in almost every kind of cancer. Where are things now in terms of immune checkpoint antibodies in hematologic cancers?
I'm very excited about the potential role of checkpoint inhibitors in leukemias. And I know that this is the new fashion. Checkpoint inhibitors are working across many solid tumors. They have shown activity in Hodgkin's disease and other lymphomas. And because of this set of very positive data, we have developed a very large program at MD Anderson of checkpoint inhibitors in leukemias. To give you an idea, we have over 200 patients now treated with checkpoint inhibitors and low-intensity therapy. And in the setting of AML refractory relapse disease, we're starting to see very interesting data that seems to be similar to what was seen in melanoma. That is, the response rate may be the same as with the chemotherapy, but we are seeing durable responses. So we're letting this data mature, and we're hoping that if at the follow-up of 2 years we still see hopefully 30% of the patients who are using a combination of epigenetic therapy and checkpoint inhibitors in the setting of refractory relapse AML who continue to be alive with stable disease, that would be a breakthrough. But we do not have enough mature data to make those claims yet. With this caveat, I'm very excited about the potential role of checkpoint inhibitors in AML, both in active disease and perhaps in the frontline therapy in patients who are in remission. We have introduced them in the context of myelodysplastic syndrome and in the context of myeloproliferative disorders, and I think they will have an expanding role which could be similar to what we see in the solid tumors.
Have checkpoint inhibitors been given to people with AML? Do we know anything about responses even in the phase one setting?
So this is what I was alluding to. We have in the clinic close to 200 patients with acute myeloid leukemia, with CLL, with other leukemias that we have treated with the checkpoint inhibitors. And as I alluded to, in the setting of active refractory acute myeloid leukemia, the combination of hypomethylating agents with checkpoint inhibitors is starting to show data that to me looks quite promising. But we're not at the stage where we can make claims in terms of the longer-term benefit.
What about checkpoint inhibitors alone? Do they have any activity?
In the setting of acute myeloid leukemia, we have not seen in the data that we've collected so far single agent activity. I think the activity is going to be more in combination with some forms of low intensity standard chemotherapy or in the setting of remission.
Any particular disease that you think might be more amenable to checkpoint therapy, AML, MDS?
We're testing it. You would think that more indolent disorders will allow for an evaluation of the checkpoint inhibitors in the longer term. So I'm hoping that situations like myelodysplastic syndrome, myeloproliferative disorders, chronic lymphocytic leukemia will be situations where we can define a better role perhaps for single agent checkpoint inhibitors in the setting of remissions such as acute myeloid leukemia and remission, perhaps chronic myeloid leukemia and remission where we want to increase the durable complete molecular response rates. We mentioned venetoclax as a BCL2 inhibitor that could kill the residual stem cell. Checkpoint inhibitors could have that same effect. But I personally am quite excited about the role of the checkpoint inhibitors, and this is why we have associated on a broad collaboration using checkpoint inhibitors in combination with other checkpoint inhibitors as well as checkpoint inhibitors in combination with standard therapies.
Let's talk a little bit about MDS. Anything that's come out in the last 6 months, ASH and ASCO, in terms of new research data that you want to comment on?
There are two or three areas in MDS which I think are promising. The first one is the role of oral hypomethylating agents, such as oral decitabine and oral azacitidine. These seem to be quite promising and at least as equally effective as the subcutaneous and IV formulation. The second aspect is the development of a second generation hypomethylating agents. One particular one is SGI-110, which is now named guadecitabine because it's two molecules. One is guanosine and the other one is decitabine. So the maturing data in salvage AML, in frontline AML, and in MDS are showing that guadecitabine may be positive lead in the treatment of myelodysplastic syndrome. So we're starting to propose studies combining guadecitabine with some of the drugs mentioned earlier, such as in combination with venetoclax, with checkpoint inhibitors, with vosaroxin, and with others.
Any clinical issues in terms of management of MDS that you want to comment on? Any myths or misperceptions you think exist out there about the disease?
I think one misperception is that patients with MDS who fail frontline therapy still have a very indolent disease. And what we found when we looked at our historical data is patients with MDS who fail azacitidine or decitabine, if they fail with high-risk disease, they have a median survival of 5 to 6 months. If they fail with low-risk disease, they live longer, but the median survival is again close to about 15 months. So MDS post failure of hypomethylating agent is an area of medical need. And this is why many MDS investigators and drug companies are looking for agents that could improve the outcome of MDS post failure of hypomethylating agents, because their median survival is quite poor, in the range of 5 to 15 months, depending on whether they fail with a high blast count or with a low blast count.
Any comments on the use of hypomethylating agents, also choice of hypomethylating agents and schedule?
No, I think the hypomethylating agents appear to be equivalent. So we have azacitidine, which is subcutaneously given for 7 days, the decitabine, which is given intravenously for 5 days. One area of interest is the use of lower dosages of hypomethylating agents in the earlier MDS categories. And what we found is subcutaneous azacitidine given for 4 days or IV decitabine given for 3 days. Such agents are very safe and highly effective in the earlier phases of MDS. So I think we are going to see more of the usage of lower doses of epigenetic therapy earlier in myelodysplastic syndrome.